Adam Mark River, the Duke Wetland Center, I work with Professor Kurt Richardson. And specifically today, I'm going to talk about three main points: the role of particulate versus dissolved phosphorus in stormwater. My overall dissertation, I'll look at rural versus urban watersheds, and I'll just see the little case of that today. And I'm going to focus quite a bit on the relationship between phosphorus and particles. For example, can we predict phosphorus transport removal from a particle size distribution? And also on the ultimate fate of particulate nutrients as they move from stormwater into a constructed wetland or reservoir. So this is my study site in the North Carolina Piedmont, Upper Falls Lake. There's about 500,000 people get their drinking water from this watershed between Raleigh and Durham. Here's some field sampling methods that we use. It's a very, very mixed-use watershed. There's a mixture of urban, forest, pasture, agriculture, and it's fairly gentle slope. You know, the majority of the watershed is less than 5 degrees slope. Highly weathered. Estimates of maybe several million years old, at least a couple million years old soils in this area. So in the Piedmont, in our area, storm flow dominates the overall annual flow. This is not a snowmelt hydrology. This is a pulsed storm system. Here's several years of hydrograph, just to give you guys an idea. There's very low base flow and then these big storm events. The logarithmic scale kind of shows some of the seasonal patterns, but you just see these multiple pulses of storms. And when you look at the overall flow that comes from storm flow, we're somewhere around 75% or so of just the quantity of water comes during high flow events in our area of Piedmont. So if we think about the flux of nutrients, we also need to factor in the concentration in addition to the flow. So if you look at general storm hydrographs, here's a couple of urban storms. You see that there's quite a spike in suspended solids and phosphorus during these high flow events. So we get quite an increase in concentration. Here's some TSS filters that I pulled starting at the beginning of the hydrograph, working through the end of the hydrograph. And you can see we get this kind of a first flush phenomenon where we get these really high concentrations of suspended sediment in the water and the phosphorus that's associated with that. The rural streams in our area are similar. Maybe they track the hydrograph just a little better, but again, high flow means higher concentrations of particulates in the water. Versus the dissolved, this is DOC and total dissolved nitrogen. They tend to peak later in the storm event after that water's had some chance to interact more with the soil via interflow and groundwater flow. So when we think about overall flux and we multiply the concentration times the flow for these events, we're looking at around 90% of the phosphorus delivery comes during storms for the rural systems. And if we get more in the urban systems, you might be more around 75 or 80% because they release some wastewater treatment effluent at base flow. We'll just use that down just a little bit. But basically, if you're going to control the particulate nutrients, you need to control the storm flow and be able to manage that. So when we start thinking about soluble versus particulate phosphorus, you know, why do we even care? Why don't we just manage the total phosphorus loading? Well, when I first started in Kurt's lab, it was just a quick, took some really high TSS stormwater, came in and did the standard 0.45 micron filter to get the dissolved phosphorus. This is what I got. And so to me, that's really not very dissolved. It looks like a lot of particles in there. So I took a 0.02 micron filter just to get a little better feel for that. And indeed, you see you're still removing particles down when you drop filter size. So the 0.45 microns definitely letting a lot of these small clay particles come through. And that kind of got me started down this path of my research of thinking about particle size distribution of the storm flow. So I did a little total phosphorus experiment where I used different sizes of filters. And you can see versus the unfiltered stormwater, which is maybe between 500 and 600 micrograms per liter phosphorus, the 0.45 micron filter cuts that at least by half, but it's still about four times higher than if you really cut down to a very small filter. So whenever you read about dissolved phosphorus in the literature and you see they use 0.45 micron filter, just maybe be a little skeptical of that. And in your own research, if you do use some dissolved numbers, you might just try using a smaller filter and see if you get a different result. The reason that's important is because the different phosphorus species have different implications for removal. So if it's true free orthophosphate, which I think is back in the day is what that is designed to replicate, that can be readily taken up by microbes. It has different biogeochemical ramifications versus organic phosphorus, which might be dissolved but yet needs some time to break down in the system. And if it's sorbed phosphorus, actually tiny little particles, that can have also a wide range of biogeochemistry. It can be desorbed, it can be permeably buried, anoxic versus oxic conditions can determine its fate. So we need to understand the species of phosphorus in our water to be able to correctly design a best management practice. This is a BMP that we have in Duke Forest. Called antibranching. We take some of the stormwater flow, put it out onto the floodplain to reconnect it. But you can just see here, we're dropping out a lot of that sediment, a lot of that particulate phosphorus compared to the main stem of the storm flow here. So it's just one example of how you understand what's in your water and the species of phosphorus, you can better manage that. So I'm going to go to the second part of my talk where I'm going to talk about phosphorus and particles, and in particular the dependence on particle size. So particle size has two really important functions that we think about phosphorus transport. Number one is the settling velocity. The sphere is a function of diameter squared. So this is Stokes' law. It's fun if you need some bedtime reading or read some of his papers. But basically, the diameter squared determines the settling velocity. And then the surface area of the sphere, which is a proxy for sorption sites, cation exchange and such, is also a function of diameter squared, just simple geometry. So particle size is driving two functions here when we think about how phosphorus is moving. And most of our soils in the Piedmont are clays, highly, highly weathered system. We have a lot of very small clays. And the problem with clays is while they do have low erodibility because of their cohesive sediments, once they're entrained in the runoff, they take forever to settle out. I mean, you can go days after a storm and still just see muddy puddles around campus or whatnot. And here's just a quick little Excel spreadsheet that I did. I went from fine sand to some of the fine and colloidal clays. And even if you put a logarithmic axis, still get this incredible ramping up the time it takes to settle out these very small particles. And then I did some particle size distribution. I'll talk about the method I used, but I just want to drill home here that in our area, the Piedmont, the particle size, we're somewhere around 0.5, 0.6, 0.7 microns for the vast majority of our stormwater. And almost everything's under a micron. You know, we do have some silts and a few sands mixed in as well. The vast majority of particles are these submicron colloidal clay particles. So if we know the particle size distribution, we can predict the movement of phosphorus. So this is something I've been playing around with, basically taking Stokes' law multiplied by surface area. And if you take a summation over all the diameters of the particles in your stormwater, that lets you basically model the removal in the stormwater sediment basin, right? And so how we actually get the stormwater particle size distribution is flow imaging particle size analysis. These are really cool little high-tech machines that basically we're taking advantage of digital photography and good optics nowadays on camera lenses. And you take your water sample and it pumps it through this thin lens where you have a camera and a magnifying lens. And it takes very, very rapid digital photos of your stormwater sample, which ends up looking something like this. And each of those individual particles is counted and measured. And then you might end up with tens of thousands. So my sample had a couple hundred thousand pieces that were counted. So the statistics are very robust on this type of a method, which is kind of nice. And you set it up with a 4.6 micron quality control to calibrate the machine. And so that's 4.6 microns as the machine is looking at it. Here's some stormwater from our area in Piedmont. You can see it's pretty small compared to the 4.6 quality control. Many of you guys are still drinking coffee this time of the day. It looks quite a bit like some of the microgram coffee, so you can just think about that next time you're having your Starbucks. And if you drop it down to that very small filter, this just shows that indeed you do remove the particles from your sample and you get a more of a true soluble phosphorus estimate. So to understand how phosphorus works with particles, we need to know whether total surface area is a good proxy for particulate phosphorus. So I'm going to go through a couple of quick methods on how I'm looking at that. One is using turbidity as a proxy, because that's a quick and easy in-situ measurement that we can make. And the second method is using that particle size distribution to calculate the relative surface area. So with turbidity, there's three different subwatersheds here, and we have a very strong relationship in each subwatershed between turbidity on the x-axis and total phosphorus on the y-axis. So it does indeed seem to be it could be a good method. Nice thing about turbidity, they're in-situ probes, and I take 15-minute measurements with them and then lay it over the USGS stream gauges at the same site to get real-time matching up with the actual flow, which if turbidity then lets you predict the phosphorus, you can then get flux calculations from this. So I think there's a lot of promise here. In fact, I just got a grant to buy some more turbidity meters to study this more. But I think this is a really promising technique to estimate phosphorus. The second method, if we look at that particle size distribution and that equation that takes the summation of the individual particle surface area and adds them all up, we see that's another method that we can use to predict particulate phosphorus based on the surface area. We get a pretty strong relationship. Basically, the more particles and the more surface area, the more phosphorus is being transported in that stormwater. What that lets us do is actually make some of those mold predictions. So again, there's that same equation. I did a couple different lab experiments, brought water in, settled it out, took phosphorus readings at different times, and indeed I was able with the blue line to predict my actual lab readings, which are the red here. Here's the second experiment. You see we can model pretty accurately, just knowing the particle size distribution, can model how that phosphorus is being removed in a wetland basin. So the last part of my talk, I want to mention what happens with these particles now, what's the ultimate fate? They're washing down during stormwater, now they're reaching a wetland, or they're reaching the upper end of a reservoir where it's shallow and they're settling out. What happens on a decadal scale, you know, years and decades? So I'm going out, the technique is I'm using a Russian core with a long stem, and then my trusty canoe. You go out and you take 50 centimeter sediment cores. Most of these reservoirs are 30, 40, 50 years old in our area, so you're able to get down most of the sediments that have been deposited since they were built. And this is what the actual sediment cores look like. You might have sandy sediments, really blade sediments. You might have some where you can see some old leaf path that's been deposited with different storms. You might have some really oxidized, you know, clay-looking sediments here. And so I basically analyzed this with phosphorus, nitrogen, carbon, and iron. And I'm going to show you just a few of the quick relationships here. There seems to be a relationship between iron and phosphorus in these sediments. So just kind of a general trend, more iron means more phosphorus. But there's also more iron, or more carbon means more phosphorus. So as the percent carbon increases with organic matter, we also get a positive relationship. So it looks like there's some type of a dual control on the phosphorus content of the sediments based on the iron and the carbon content. And I'm going to tease that out some more in future dissertation research here. But contrast that to the nitrogen content of the sediments, which is very, very tight with the carbon. Basically, the more carbon you have, the more nitrogen, and it tends to be a pretty similar carbon to nitrogen ratio. So with those sediment cores, I'm taking sections throughout, basically different time stamps of when the sediment was deposited, and looking at how that organic matter is breaking down over time. And so the carbon to nitrogen ratio is really consistent, whether you're at the top 2 centimeters, the very recent deposits, or the bottom at 50 centimeter mark. So even though that's been there 30, 35 years decomposing, it basically has the same C to N ratio, which I think is kind of interesting. Whereas the carbon to phosphorus ratio changes quite a bit. And my takeaway from this is basically that organic matter is decomposing, it's releasing carbon and the nitrogen and the phosphorus, but the phosphorus is getting rebound with the sediments because of high iron values, I think, and it's not going back into the water. Or doesn't have a gaseous phase that's getting locked into the sediments. Here's one more way of looking at that. This is a percent nitrogen of the top sediments here and the bottom sediments here. We can see there's quite a difference over time, about a 40% reduction in nitrogen. Whereas the phosphorus, there's that, which is this graph here, there's actually no statistical significance between those means. So again, the nitrogen is being released, the phosphorus seems to be getting bound, the majority of it. So you end up getting a disproportionate burial of phosphorus in these stormwater sediments as they wash into a wetland or a reservoir. And I did a phosphorus sorption experiment in the lab to kind of understand better how these sediments have the ability to bind phosphorus. And when you add up to about 5 or 10, especially at 5 milligrams per liter, which is a lot of phosphorus, that's even, you know, secondary wastewater dependent, you know, isn't quite that high either. You can basically bind nearly all of that with these sediments in lab experiments. So these sediments have an incredible ability to bind phosphorus, and I think that's why it's not being re-released. So conclusions so far in my research, the majority of phosphorus flux is particulate and it's coming in storm events. There's different ways of thinking about particles with surface area, but basically there is a strong relationship and that allows us to predict phosphorus movement and removal in these systems. On the 4.45 micron filter, just word for the wise, just be cautious if you're using any data where that's your filter size, especially if you have a lot of clays, because there could be some clays making through there. And then I'm going to work more on this carbon and iron association with nitrogen and phosphorus. So future work, I've got that grant to buy some more turbidity meters. I'm looking at some scanning electron microscope to better understand how these particles are shaped and how the iron is coating these particles. And then I'm also looking at some nitrogen and phosphorus fate in sediment with lead-210 and cesium-137. I'm going to be doing some single isotope work and maybe some oxygen isotope of phosphate, perhaps a 31B NMR. Thank you.
Do we have any questions?
That was a great talk, Mark. I was curious how your cores, how the iron concentration compared
Yeah, I don't have a slide for that, but it was really similar to how this phosphorus looks here, that there's just a very slight difference from the top to the bottom four of the iron content, which, you know, when I go back and see how glazed some of these sediments are, it looks like there shouldn't be much iron, and certainly not much oxidized iron in there. But surprisingly, there's not much difference between the iron content of a core like this and a core like that when you look at a total iron. So one thing that Dr. Richardson and I have talked about doing is some like free iron extraction or some to look at more of the oxide and see maybe total iron is not the best proxy. Maybe there's some other iron matrices that we can use to better predict the phosphorus content. But it's consistent down through the sediment core.
Like the C-N ratio doesn't show a lot of depth.
No, it doesn't. It's pretty much consistent about 4% or so throughout that sediment core, maybe between 3-5% from top to bottom. Except for the sandy sediments, but in the clay sediments, several percent, no matter where you are in the sediment floor.
Yeah. So we're technically on break, but
okay. I'll be around during break, and we can
chat. We continue to have questions if you would rather, since we've had a few breaks through the session so far. But
I'll be around, we can chat during break. So.
Okay.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.